performs Schubert live in concert on Tuesday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3, or listen in HD sound via the Radio 3 website.
Well, just looking ahead to this afternoon at 3 o'clock, we've Choral Evensong, another chance to hear Wednesday's service from Liverpool Cathedral with music by Percy Whitlock, William Walton, Charles Villa Stanford and Gabrielli. At 4, as I said, Sarah Moore-Peach will be here with the choir, and then our Words and Music programme in the Great War aftermath. James Wilby and Helen Baxendale will be reading poetry and prose by Sassoon, Whitman and Gurney, reflecting a world changed by conflict, with music by Elgar Ravel and Ives. That's 5:30. At 6:45, our Sunday feature is called World War One, Cradle of Jazz, and Alan Shipton will be looking at the original Dixieland jazz band from 1917. He sets out to chart the evolution of jazz from ragtime at a time when few recordings exist. And there'll be archive interviews with Jesse Stone, Jock Cheatham, Jelly Roll Morton and Willie the Lion Smith. That's our Sunday feature, 6:45 this evening, here on BBC Radio 3. Well, the time now is just 2 o'clock, and it's time for the early music show. Piers Adams in Berlin presents the second of three programmes celebrating the 300th anniversary of the birth of Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach.
The year is 1740, and the 26-year-old Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach has just arrived here at the magnificent palace of Charlottenburg in Berlin to begin officially his new job in the court of the newly crowned Frederick the Great of Prussia. Frederick was not only one of Europe's most powerful monarchs, but he was also a great patron of music and a musician himself, and his court attracted some of the finest composers and performers in the land. The young Bach must surely have been feeling that the world lay at his feet. How wrong he was. Thank you. That was the opening movement of Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach's Symphony No. 1 in G major, composed in 1741, when he was still a fresh face here in King Frederick's court. It was performed by the Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach Chamber Orchestra under the baton of Harmut Henken, and it comes from one of three important multi-CD sets released in this Bach's tercentenary year. Now, to get an idea of what life was like in Frederick's court at this time, we're now going to talk to the current manager of Charlottenburg Palace. We're standing here in one of the gorgeous rooms in the palace, and we're talking to Rudolf G. Sharman. Rudolf, thank you very much for talking to us. Can you maybe tell us why Frederick has the name Frederick the Great? What was it that was particularly great about this monarch?
When he came onto the throne, his father had not fought against foreign enemies in Europe. He was the so-called soldier king, but he never fought against other countries. And then Frederick came, and he was a man who was very fond of him. And he wanted to be the most famous king in Europe. And therefore, he fought against Austria, against Maria Theresia, for example. And he wanted to enlarge his countries. And after the Seven-Year Wars, and also after the so-called Silesian Wars, he was called the Great, because half part of Austria belonged to Prussia. And then parts of Poland came to the countries of Prussia and so on. And he was a very famous Prussian king.
It's a very unusual combination, this idea of a king being both a military genius and a very prodigious musical talent. Can you tell us a little about his background and how he came to be this type of person?
Yes, when Frederick the Great came to the throne in 1740, he was very fond of music because his grandmother, the famous Queen Sophie Charlotte, lived here in Charlottenburg Palace, and she was interested in the Italian composers in her times and also in philosophics, because Leibniz, the famous philosopher, was very often here in Charlottenburg Palace.
So I understand that Frederick the Great's father wasn't particularly keen on fostering his son's musical talent. He was more of a military man, wasn't he?
Yes, he was very fond of hunting and of soldiers and all these things. But the mother of Frederick the Great, Sophie Dorothea, she was the sister of George II of Great Britain and Ireland. She loved the music. And also the sister, the eldest sister of Frederick the Great, Wilhelmine, the later famous Margrave of Bayreuth, those two children, they came to the mother, and then they played on the harpsichords and flutes and so on. And that was important for the king and also for his youth.
Now, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, he arrived here in 1740 in this palace, but prior to that, he had been under the employ of Frederick the Great, but sort of in secret, is that correct?
I think so, yes.
Just to keep this from his father?
Yes. The father died in the spring, and then Frederick the Great came onto the throne, and he lived in these rooms here. And I think Bach and Frederick the Great, they played here in this oval hall, the great oval hall, and you have a general overlook onto the beautiful garden, onto the Baroque garden here in front of you. And they were sitting here. Bach was playing on the cembalo and Frederick playing the flute, the solo instrument, and this was the first time that they stayed here in Charlottenburg Palace.
Marvellous. Well, let's hear what that would have sounded like with this recording from Musica Ad Rhoenanum. Thank you. That was the final movement of the Sonata in A Minor by Emanuel Bach, played there by the flautist Jed Wentz with Michael Borgstedter on harpsichord and the cellist Job Ter Haar, who together make up the ensemble Musica Ad Rainem. Well, we're standing here in the upper oval hall of the palace at Charlottenburg, and this, we think, may well have been the room where Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach first accompanied King Frederick on the flute. So really amazing. It's a fantastic room with floor-to-ceiling windows and a view over these amazing gardens. A very light and inspiring room, and a perfect room for music making. So talking here to Rudolf G. Sharman, the manager at Charlottenburg, who telling us a little more about the life and times of the musicians in the court here. Can you tell us what the daily life would have been like for these musicians? There were many famous musicians from all over Europe congregated here.
Well, I think Frederick in the morning, after having breakfast, the first was the flute. The first interesting thing was the flute, and then the musicians had to be entering the palace and also this oval hall, and then they were playing, and afterwards he was looking after the soldiers and his duties, the daily duties, and having dinner, and afterwards playing once again. Yes, the music was so important in his life that every minute he has free, the music was his most delighting factor.
I think every monarch could learn from this. It must be a wonderful way to balance your life. Mm. So the musicians here, they had a job to compose for and accompany King Frederick, mm-hmm. and also write music for other occasions at the palace?
Yes, mostly for little festivals, theatre, small operas and so on.
And many of them were also involved teaching Frederick the Great, is that right? Particularly Kvanz.
Mm-hmm. And Graun.
So there were many very well-known, well-loved composers here at the palace, and Emanuel Bach arrived into this illustrious company. Do you think he was immediately one of the favourite composers of the king?
Yes, I think so, but Graun was much more important for him.
So was Carl Philipp a little down in the pecking order?
A little bit. Yes, I think Bach was a more modern musician, and Frederick was interested in the Italian music. It was a little bit old-fashioned. But Bach, the modern man, and on the other side, Kvanz and Graun, they supported Frederick in his style.
Frederick the Great is probably very unusual, probably unique as a monarch in being able to actually compose a symphony as well as run a country.
He was no expert because the musicians were here on the court, but it was one of the most important things in his life. The beloved mother, the beloved sister in Bayreuth, and the music.
Well, we're now going to hear an instance of Frederick the Great's own composition. This comes from his Symphony No. 1. Thank you. Well, that was the first movement of Symphony No. 1 by Frederick the Great, performed by the Ensemble Sanssouci, directed by Christoph Hundgeburt. Playing the harpsichord on this recording was Natalie Pfeiffer, and we've now whizzed across Berlin to speak to her and hear her play at the Institute for Artistic Training in Early Music and Historic Performance Practice in Berlin University of the Arts. Now, Natalie, Frederick earned the title Frederick the Great for his military victories, especially during the Seven-Year War. But was he a great musician?
I think he must have been a very good flute player, judging from his sonatas, which are very virtuosic, but they also give plenty of opportunity for very tasteful melodic playing. I think he must have been very good at what he was doing, yes.
And how does compositions, how do they rate compared to someone like Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach?
That is, of course, a difficult comparison to make, because Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach was a fantastic composer, son of Johann Sebastian Bach. You would expect that, obviously. And Frederick the Great was an amateur musician. He was extremely high-level amateur musician, but he was an amateur musician. So I would think, from having read most of his sonatas with my flute colleague when we were trying to make a program, that there's always beautiful melodies in his compositions, but sometimes they're a little bit simple, a little bit shallow, as goes the harmonic progressions. And the form, the style of the movements is always also very traditional. He was not exactly venturing very far with his style. So I would say good work what he did. But of course he had people superseding him in his time and at his court, actually.
So in what ways did Carl Philipp Emanuel express himself, and how was he moving forward from this style?
Well, I'd say that he's moving forward, of course, not only from the style of his contemporaries, which weren't quite as brilliant as him, but that he was also moving forward, and particularly moving forward, from the compositions of the generations before him. So the generation of his father, which is a generation very, very rich in harmony. Of course, the harmony being informed by the counterpoint from which it had developed. And I think he was very much moving away from that, but finding his own way of giving music meaning and finding expression in music with a different kind of harmony.
Is there a particular piece that could demonstrate this very well?
There's a piece that I like very much that could demonstrate that, I think, very nicely, which is the Fantasia in E flat major. He composed this piece probably around 1740. It's not exactly clear, because there's only a handwritten manuscript of his. He didn't publish this piece. He might have given it away to a friend or a student and then simply lost track of it and didn't publish it later. And in this piece, the style is extremely free. There is no shape or form that you could compare to a sonata, or you could compare to any of the compositions of his father. So really, he is just very much letting his thoughts flow, letting the emotions flow, and that comes through the music very nicely.
Well, that was the Fantasia in E-flat major by Emmanuel Bach. What an amazing piece of music. Natalie Pfeiffer at the harpsichord there. Really music that almost defies description. At times it sounds like J.S. Bach. At times it sounds like you're in the middle of a Liszt sonata. At times it sounds like we're listening to a silent movie. It's really, really wonderful music. Do you like this style? You obviously really enjoy it.
Yes, I'm very keen on discovering these pieces at the moment. I have to say, for a long time, I've been a harpsichordist for 20 years now, and for a long time, I didn't feel like I could connect to CPE's music, really. I often felt that because the harmony is taken away, in a sense, from the way it was used in the Baroque period, and that's the music that we cherish so much, the chocolatey harmonies in French Baroque music and or in Johann Sebastian Bach. For a long time, I felt that I didn't quite understand how emotion and affect works in CPE's music. CPE himself says that he would like every player to be able to feel the emotions of the music at that particular moment. If you try to do it intellectually, at least that's what I tried to do before, it doesn't work. I think you have to really try to do it intuitively. You have to imagine what the sound should be. And the clearer the idea is what the sound should be, the ways of making it possible actually will just come out.
So one can well imagine that Frederick the Great might have been almost quite frightened by music like that if he was a more conservative musician. To hear something as wild and free as that, maybe that wasn't entirely to his taste.
Absolutely not. He certainly liked the form and the shape of his music to be very, very clear, so he didn't like this free music.
Now, the first famous set of sonatas, if you like, by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach are the so-called Prussian sonatas. Can you explain why these are considered such important works?
I think they became very popular because they're very beautiful in style, and at the same time they make it possible for both a conservative listener to appreciate them as well as the person who has already arrived in the new style. They became classics, as it were, in the 18th century. They were republished many, many times. And certainly composers later on, like Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, they all wanted to see this music, they all wanted to study from this music, and they all wanted to study CPE's new style from these sonatas.
Wow, that was the presto from the Sonata in C minor by C.P.E. Bach. That's one of the Prussian sonatas published in 1742. Natalie Pfeiffer was grinning away as she tackled that fiendish passage work in that piece. Obviously, you really enjoy this very virtuosic, exciting music which Bach seemed to come pouring out of the man.
And it's very much also a virtuosity that is melodic. So every time he comes up with a new idea, it's something that one could sing. Whereas try singing some of the pieces of his father, or indeed the fugues, you couldn't do it.
Most certainly not. So maybe that partly explains the popularity of his music at this time. Now, he dedicated these works to his patron and employer, Frederick the Great. But also he started off something by publishing this. He started off something which really took him to a much wider public as a musician than Frederick himself could ever achieve.
He certainly could make a lot of money with his compositions that were popular, not only because they were wonderful pieces of art, wonderful works, but also because he published pieces that would be not only for a very professional player, but also for a beginner, for an amateur. So people who had a clavier at the time at home, which incidentally was the clavichord and not a harpsichord, most people wouldn't have been able to afford harpsichords, but they might have had a clavier at home. They could have played these pieces and had great fun, so he could make a lot of good money with that in his lifetime. But also later on, other composers in the generations after him were very keen and eager to see his works and get those publications.
So in this way, he really established his status as maybe one of the leading keyboardists in Europe. And he capitalized on this by publishing his essay on the true art of keyboard playing, which I understand is very, very important for you keyboardists.
Yes, it was very widely looked at and used at the time. And it gives the keyboard player a lot of information about what was done in the generations before Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, and it gives a lot of information about what he thinks is lacking. So it's a wonderful piece to read, and I would suggest it not only for people who are interested in old music performance practice, but indeed anybody who plays the piano, I think, would have a lot of fun and would do well reading the Versuch.
So was his essay more about the technique of playing the keyboard, or was it a more general musical manual?
There are a lot of interesting informations about playing technique in the book. One most interesting maybe is that he talks about fingering and about the use of the thumbs in fingering indeed, as was frowned upon in generations before him. But I would say the main interesting bits for us today are the places where he talks about playing music and playing in affect, really. One quote that I like very much from his book, and please allow me to say it in German and then I'll try to paraphrase in English. Indem ein Musikus nicht anders rühren kann, sei denn selbst gerührt. So he's saying a musician cannot possibly move the audience if he is not moved himself by the music. Gibt ihnen seine Empfindung zu verstehen und bewegt sie solcher Gestalt am besten zur Mitempfindung. So by transporting his own emotion that he feels from the music to the public, he can move them. And of course there he's saying something very different to what his colleague Quanz wrote in his book, because Quanz says that it is very important to understand the affects in the music, and then the musician needs to be able to have the technical means to make it sound, but that one should not be affected the same way as not to lose control. And Carl Philipp is saying exactly the opposite. He's saying, no, you must feel it yourself, otherwise you cannot convincingly say it to the public with the music.
So music, in a sense, becomes like method acting, where you have to completely embody the character of the piece, the feeling.
You have to absolutely believe it yourself. I'd like to give you one more quote, which he says here. So unanständig und schädlich hässliche Gebärden sind, so nützlich sind die guten. So he says, making gestures when you play that are ugly or that do not fit the affect, of course, that is a very bad thing. But good gestures that have to do with the emotions that take place in the music at that moment are a good thing. So he's saying, please, musicians, don't sit in front of the harpsichord like a piece of wood, but move with the music. Indem sie unsere Absichten bei den Zuhörern zu Hilfe kommen. And that, of course, helps the listener to understand the music better.
So, do you have anything else you'd like to play for us from Bach's extensive keyboard repertoire?
One of his publication ideas was to publish pieces where he would himself embellish repeats of sonatas. Nowadays, none of us would think of playing a Mozart sonata and suddenly changing the music when we do the repeat. In fact, Carl Philipp did it with his own sonatas, and it was done at the time. But as he says in his Versuch, sometimes it was done very badly, and he was very unhappy with how badly sometimes the musicians would treat his pieces. So he would compose sonatas and publish them that had changes in the repeats. And there's also small pieces that he published that are just a minute or two long. And I could play you one of those if you
please. Like. The harpsichord is Natalie Pfeiffer playing the Poco Allegro in E minor. That comes from one of C.P.E. Bach's sonatas with varied repeats, which he wrote and dedicated to Frederick the Great's younger sister, Anna Amalia, of whom we'll be hearing a little bit more later. But for now, we've taken a trip to Frederick's summer palace in Potsdam, which carries the rather whimsical name Sans Souci, or No Worries. and I'm speaking here to Dr. Julia Klein, who's one of the assistant curators. So Julia, what brought him to build this wonderful palace?
Well, Sanssouci Palace was built to fulfill Frederick the Great's need for a private residence away from the pomp and ceremony of the Berlin court. The palace, based on the king's ideas, is relatively small and consists only of a central marble hall with a royal apartment and 5 guest rooms. And during the summer, the king of Prussia spent his time at Sanssouci Palace, his Acadian retreat, to live in seclusion in a circle of only few people, his inner circle.
So that inner circle presumably included his musical friends and colleagues.
Yeah,
we have a wonderful painting here of presumably Frederick the Great playing the flute in his very room. It's a most beautiful ornate music room with a wonderful forte piano there in the middle and a gilded ceiling like none other you've ever seen. And here he is playing the flute with a number of other musicians around. Maybe you could talk us through this painting.
Yeah, you see Frederick in front of his music stand playing the flute. He was himself a talented amateur. And right to him on the forte piano is sitting Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach with a scornful look against Frederick.
Oh, why does Bach have such a scornful look?
Yeah, well, when Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach became a member of the Royal Orchestra in 1741, Berlin was an attractive place for musicians. And shortly after his accession to the throne in 1740, the new King of Prussia built, for example, the opera Unter den Linden and gave Karl Heinrich Graun instructions to hire Italian singers. Yeah, also for other reasons, the situation in Berlin was not that satisfying for Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. He earned only 300 Reichstaler, which was a relatively small salary. And even though he was engaged at the Prussian court, he was dependent on an extra income. For example, he gave lessons. So it was not that happy here in Potsdam.
Well, the palace at Potsdam may be relatively modest. It's a kind of single-story dwelling centering on Frederick the Great's hallowed music room, but the grounds are far from modest. In fact, they stretch for a long way with beautiful views of fountains, trees, lakes, and so on. It truly is an Arcadian paradise, but it does seem that Emanuel Bach really didn't enjoy it as much as he might. In fact, many years later, when the historian Charles Burney was passing through Hamburg and caught up with Emanuel Bach, he had this to say: although Bach continued near 30 years in Berlin, it cannot be supposed that he was perfectly contented with his situation. A style of music prevailed, totally different from that which he had wished to establish. His salary was inconsiderable, and he ranked below several that were greatly inferior to him in merit. Frequent opportunities offered during this period for his establishing himself very advantageously elsewhere, some of which he wished to accept, but he could not obtain his dismission. Well, things got even more difficult for court musicians during the Seven Years' War, and many had to look outside the court to earn their crust. Well, Emanuel Bach, being a pretty industrious fellow, had little trouble with this, and he was able to supplement his income both with private teaching and, of course, with income from his music sales, his publishing. And surprisingly, during this period, he was also able to produce some very fine works, chamber pieces and even orchestral pieces, which were intended for domestic performance. We're going to hear one such piece now. It's a rather charming and unusual minuet, and it comes from a sonatina for harpsichord, 2 flutes, here played on recorders, and strings. And it's performed by Collegium Pro Musica, directed by Stefano Bagliano. That was the Sonatina in E-flat by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, played there by Collegium Pro Musica, with Stefano Bagliano directing and playing the recorder. It came from a time when Carl Philipp was becoming increasingly alienated from the court of Frederick the Great. But he did actually find a royal friend there in the king's younger sister, Princess Anna Amalia. She was also a music lover and clearly appreciated Emanuel's progressive musical taste and his independent spirit, probably rather a lot more so than her conservative older brother. She was also an amateur organist, and to find out a little more about her, we've now travelled to the Church of the Good Message in East Berlin, where Anna Amalia's own organ lives on. Well, that was Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach in typically exuberant and capricious mood in the opening movement to his organ sonata number 4 in A minor, dedicated to his friend Princess Anna Amalia, and brilliantly played there by Beata Krupka on the princess's own organ, recently restored and now housed in the Church of the Good Message in East Berlin. With me here is Stefan Rudolph, retired ambassador and a member of the Friends of the Anna Amalia Organ. Now, Stefan, so what can you tell us about Princess Anna Amalia, her story, and how she came to be friends with Carl Philipp Emanuel?
Well, Anna Amalia was a sister of Frederick II. He was an elder brother, and he somehow took care also a little bit of her education, certainly of her musical education. He, as a king, as you know, was both a warrior and at the same time he was a friend of culture and in particular of music. And it was through Frederick the Great that Anna Amalia came in contact with Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach.
And they became great friends, I
guess. They became obviously great friends, and he sort of was a mentor for her musical education. She had learned already to play different instruments, violin, harpsichord, and later the organ. And when she thought that she should have for herself an organ put up in the Palais in Berlin, it was in particular Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach whom she consulted on how to build that organ.
Fantastic. So there have been rumours that Anna Amalia was actually banished by King Frederick. She became pregnant by somebody who was not appropriate for her to get married to, and she was banished to a nunnery. She rose up to become head of that nunnery. Is there any truth in these rumours?
I'm happy you don't ask Beate Krupke about this, because she hates talking about this, because she insists that all this is rumours. The fact is, however, that Anna Amalia became the abbess of Quedlinburg, which was a Protestant monastery, basically for female members of the aristocracy. And maybe already this gave rise to these rumors. For herself, however, this didn't mean a lot. She did not stay there all the time. She was mostly here in Berlin. It raised her a little bit. It also gave her some kind of financial support. But the fact that she became an abbess only meant that from then on she would not be married anymore.
So these rumours may not be true, but can we still say that Emmanuel had an ally in Princess Amalia in the court?
Well, I can't really say whether the term ally is the correct word in this context. What I do know is that they must have been on very good terms, because Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, who had taught her a lot about music, who had taught her a lot about instruments, also appreciated the fact that she was so much in favor of learning about music and playing music. And you can see from the fact that he composed music for her that he appreciated her. In particular, when the organ was first built in 1755, he composed four organ solos, and he even wrote a dedication for her in which he said, this was written for a princess who does not play the pedal, nor does she play difficulties, as he put it, but she has a beautiful organ and she loves it.
And so their warm friendship continued right to the end of his time in Berlin.
I think you can say this. You know that Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach went to Hamburg from Berlin. There are some people who think that he went to Hamburg because he got a better pay up there. But Anna Amalia saw to it that before he left, he was awarded the title of Kapellmeister, which is an honorary title, but helped also to upgrade him, so to speak, in the world of music.
So I think we'll now go back into the relative peace of the church, and we'll listen to a much more gentle work by Bach. This is the Adagio for organ, once again played by Beate Krupke.
Thank you.
That beautiful adagio for organ was composed by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach for Princess Anna Amalia, and it was played there by Beata Krupka on the princess's gorgeous and recently restored organ. Despite the support of the princess, Emanuel had long decided he must leave the confines of the Prussian court and go in search of pastures new, preferably a prestigious and lucrative job as a church Kapellmeister. As we've just heard, he finally succeeded in his quest in 1768 at the age of 54, taking over the chief job in the city of Hamburg, vacated by the death of his godfather Telemann the year before. And our next CPE Bach special, later this year on the Early Music Show, will focus on his successful Hamburg years. But for now, we'll leave you with the piece he had written many years earlier as his calling card as he tried to get his father's job at St. Thomas's in Leipzig. This is the splendid Magnificat, performed here in a vintage recording by the Tolz Boys Choir and Collegium Aureum, directed by Franz Josef Mayer.
Music by C.P.E. Bach, ending the Early Music Show, which was presented from Berlin by Piers Adams and produced by Roger Short.
Today, as part of Music in the Great War, the choir's looking at some new commissions for the centenary, including a major new choral work by Paul Spicer, who joins me to talk about it. We'll also be joining some of the rehearsals for an Anglo-German commission from the composer Torsten Rasch. My guest is Della Jones, picking her favourite choral music, and my choral classic is Berio's Sinfonia, a true musical rumpus. Join me, Sarah Moore-Peach, for the choir straight after Choral Evensong.
This is BBC Radio 3. The time is 3 o'clock, and indeed Choral Evensong is next. This service was first broadcast live from Liverpool Cathedral on Wednesday, the eve of the Feast of St Thomas the Apostle. The canticles are sung to Herbert House's 1917 setting in G, and the anthem is William Walton's Te Deum, written for the 1953 coronation of Her Majesty the Queen. The service opens now with Giovanni Gabrieli's Jubilate Deo, O be joyful in the Lord, all ye lands.
Thank you. Welcome to Liverpool Cathedral for this service of choral evensong on the eve of the feast of St. Thomas, the Apostle of the Lord, who journeyed from doubt to faith in his risen Lord. Jesus said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe."
O Lord, open our lips, and our mouths shall show forth thy grace. For God, make speed to save us.
Psalms appointed for the second evening of the month, Psalms 12, 13, and 14.